combine these communities, disrupting traditional ways of life, disrupting the environment, and this creates conflict and unfortunately in some situations violence. And this is happening across the hemisphere from Alaska to Argentina. And it's something that is increasing in nature as the prices of metals increase, or we have gold now at more than $1,600 an ounce, with high prices for other commodities. We have particularly strong demand from China, which is having a growing presence in the region. And with the advent of more mining, unfortunately, we've seen more and more conflict and problems around that. And in essence, the problems come from a variety of issues. One is the environmental problems that link to mining. Mining, talking about here, large-scale industrial mining, generates tremendous amounts of waste, generates tremendous amounts of disruption of the environment. Construction of mining pits has to be as big as 2 kilometers across, 1 kilometer deep. Waste rock dumps that can be 100 kilometers high. Problems like what's known as acid mining drainage, in which after you rock this mine, starts generating acid that leaks in the groundwater, basically rendering it unusable for whatever it has to be treated in perpetuity. If that water is ever used again for irrigation or other purposes. So these are some of the concerns that come up in terms of the impacts on local communities. And increasingly, in countries in Latin America, we see communities concerned about these impacts and taking steps to actually resist mining operations. And this has led to the cycle of violence and conflict that I mentioned earlier. To mention briefly then, touch on very briefly, through this, just
to give you a little bit of a sense of some of the things that are going on. In Guatemala, we have a situation in which you have a significant amount of mining now going into areas that are inhabited by indigenous people. 60% or more of Guatemala's population is indigenous. In many situations, they're simply not. They don't have the experience, mining companies don't have the experience to engage effectively with indigenous concerns. Indigenous peoples are concerned about the potential destruction of their land or traditional territory. And so that's a concern that comes up. And so we see this in Guatemala, in particular where there's been violence around mining projects, where there has been a significant amount of international attention and criticism of mining. In one case in particular, the Marlin Mine in Guatemala, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights actually has called for that mine to be suspended operational because of concerns about the impacts on the environment and human rights. In El Salvador, a case that Francisco will talk more in detail, we have a situation in which a Canadian mining company, as is the case in Guatemala, and I'm glad we have a representative from NAFTA here, that in the case of El Salvador, Pacific Rim Corporation, which is a Canadian mining company, is using CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, to sue the government of El Salvador, seeking $77 million in damages because it didn't approve an environmental agreement for its project there. So the government of El Salvador takes an action to protect the environment, and that being subject to a suit under the Central American Free Trade Agreement. I want to touch briefly, I know I'm running out of time. As I said, 5 minutes is not nearly enough to touch all of these issues, but just mention Peru briefly because it's really important. Country, I know it's one also that Tony and ICML are very interested in. In Peru right now, conflicts around mining have become a national political issue. And it's at the top of the agenda for the new president, Ollanta Humala, who's taking to try to address these problems. The conflicts, the protests, the violence around mining in Peru have actually threatened the viability of the industry. It is Peru's most important economic driver, so that is a critical issue for the government to take action to address. We took an important step forward in July in the passage of the Indigenous Peoples Consultation Law, which will now require the consent of Indigenous peoples to be obtained before mining and other types of extractive industries go forward. So that's an important step. But there remains a number of important things that need to be done also to address these conflicts and problems that we see around mining, driven in the high prices of commodities, interests, and challenges, and other things like that. I'll talk a bit more about some of the specific things that the organization, I think, need to be done to address these problems. Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from Francisco Pineda at Goldman Sachs. valores de principios morales y de ética. Cada quien retomemos nuestra parte. Así como la actividad minera en nuestro país, no podemos negar que una actividad tan grande lo que va a hacer es dañar más el planeta que tenemos. Eso lo hagamos en Canadá o lo hagamos en El Salvador. Toda actividad que hace, siempre a nosotros los que vivimos en las comunidades, nos ofrece que va a haber desarrollo económico. Nos dicen que nos van a respetar nuestra cultura. Nos dicen que de esa manera vamos a tener una mejor vida. Cuando nosotros hacemos un retroceso al ver las actividades que hay en los otros países como Perú, que tiene más de 500 años de seguir haciendo explotación minera metálica, cuando vemos Chile, cuando vemos Guatemala, cuando vemos Honduras, nosotros los salvadoreños, y en especial mi organización en el departamento de Cabañas, creemos que no estamos equivocados al decir que no queremos explotación minera. Si vamos a Honduras, le ofrecieron desarrollo. La gente que vive ahí sigue en pobreza. Si vamos a Guatemala, la gente que vive ahí, a la parte donde está haciendo la explotación minera, sigue en pobreza. Si nos vamos a Nicaragua, en una comunidad, incluso se llama Bonanza, tiene muchos años de estar trabajando en minería y sigue en pobreza. Entonces, no vemos para nosotros en El Salvador que va a ser alternativa la minería. ¿Por qué? Los proyectos mineros no son autosostenibles. Se terminó el oro y se van las empresas. Pero para nosotros, ¿qué es lo que queda? La poca agua que tenemos, contaminada. Y un desorden social grande, donde en caso de nosotros ya hay 4 asesinatos. Antes no había esos asesinatos. Las autoridades no llegan a concretizar las investigaciones. En el caso mío concreto, fue intento de envenenamiento. Y que sí, no sé si fue el presidente de la empresa que lo mandó, pero sí fue un trabajador de la empresa que ofrece $2,000 para que me envenenara. No se ha hecho la investigación completa. Entonces vemos que la minería es una actividad que no es amigable con el medio ambiente y no da desarrollo económico a nuestro país.
Bien, pues ya Tali ya me presentó. Mi nombre es Santos Lejos. Carlos Carrillo, en mi lengua materna, muy bien interno, que es un par de plumas que utilizan los maracanes, los sabios, los ancestros, para quitar los malos espíritus. Nosotros, como pueblo Vibrarica, de las diferentes comunidades, conformamos el Consejo Regional Vibrarica para enfrentar una lucha histórica de la que dependemos como pueblo, capaz de acabar con lo que no ha logrado acabar 5 siglos de guerra y masacre. El Tratado de Libre Comercio de América del Norte y las leyes reglamentarias que se han derivado para favorecer la operación de este neoliberal acuerdo entre México, Estados Unidos y Canadá no han hecho más que agudizar la guerra de exterminio contra los pueblos indígenas. A través de ordenamientos como la ley minera, que ha llevado a que los lugares sagrados de Vilicuta, en el desierto del Norte 14, en el estado de San Luis Potosí, México, hoy sean objeto de 22 concesiones mineras para la exploración y explotación de minerales, principalmente plata, sumando 6.326 hectáreas concesionadas, abarcando los lugares sagrados como es Vilicuta. Esto operado desde una filial mexicana llamada Real Bonanza S.A.D.C.B. Asimismo, recientemente tenemos conocimiento que la empresa colombiana S.A.D.C.B., filial de la empresa canadiense West Mining, busca explotar oro con el método de Tajo, así lo abierto en nuestro corazón sagrado de Vilicuta. Para nosotros Vilicuta es el santuario, es donde se concentran las energías potentes, donde están nuestros antepasados, donde descansan nuestros semidioses. Es por ello que Vilicuta es el santuario, es la sabiduría, ¿no?, donde descansa nuestro hermano mayor, que es el venado, pero también donde está nuestro maestro, que es el hijo, que es el mismo venado, la que nos conduce para que podamos caminar por una vida más digna. Esta empresa que busca explotar oro con el veto de Tajo a cielo abierto, entendemos que las ventas de oro que la empresa pretende aprovechar se encuentran de los lotes mineros denominados La Lira y el Bernalejo, con 77.63 y 37.88 hectáreas respectivamente. Tanto el proyecto minero de Rix Mayer Silver Corporation y la Rodina transgreden los derechos que tenemos como pueblos reconocidos en el convenio 169. Se viola lo establecido en el programa de manejo de área natural protegida de Vilicuta, que abarca casi el 70% de la concesión minera, y que como pueblo Vilicuta somos parte del Consejo de Administración. Se incumple también lo establecido en la Ley General para la Prevención y Gestión Integral de los Residuos Peligrosos. No se respetan las disposiciones de la Ley General del Equilibrio Ecológico y Protección del Ambiente, la ambiental del Estado de San Luis Potosí, así como la Ley de Consulta a Pueblos Indígenas del Estado de San Luis. No digamos los convenios y tratados que México ha ratificado y firmado, que deberían ser suficientes para que sea respetado nuestros derechos fundamentales. Para nosotros, como pueblo Vibrarica, la lucha por defender nuestro corazón colectivo que está en Vilicuta ha representado un reto, algo para lo que no estamos preparados, y es que para nuestras comunidades hablar de nuestros antepasados, de nuestras tradiciones, de nuestra forma de hacer la ceremonia, nuestros besos, del caminar de los ancestros cuando fueron naciendo la vida en el mundo, y la encomienda que nos hicieron de no dejar de hacer eso mismo para que el sol no deje de salir cada día. Y más aún, porque si se han conservado de su recuerdo desde que los primeros catoyarios salieron del mar hasta los tiempos modernos, es porque hay fuentes de esos conocimientos, fuentes tan vivas que no cesan de hablar y de cantar la palabra antigua, presente y posterior en un mismo instante, en una misma palabra, una sola palabra que se mueve, que vibra y grita, que no debe ser asesinada. Esa palabra es Vilicuta. son conocimientos muy antiguos, sellados por nosotros mismos, muy criticados en las asambleas, el que se dé a conocer a personas ajenas, por ejemplo, lo sentimos como invasión, algo que es nuestro, una invasión a lo que nos hace ser un pueblo y que hemos logrado preservar, a pesar de que desde hace más de 500 años no se ha detenido la guerra de exterminio. Sin embargo, para que el Estado mexicano entienda por qué no debe ser mina, no debe vender agroindustrias, no debe violentar ni privatizar un gran territorio de más de 140 mil hectáreas en los que tenemos edificaciones, sino que reivindicamos que esto todo sagrado desde las plantas de gobernadora, los mezquitas, los serpientes, las piedras, los minerales, ha sido algo que ha tocado fibras muy sensibles en el tejido social, político y cultural de nuestro pueblo. Realmente nos preocupa mucho, pues, toda esta situación que vivimos como pueblo vivario y que el Estado mexicano, sin mediante consulta hacia los pueblos, como los propietarios, los originarios, esté dando cabida de la entrada de empresas como es las canadienses, porque es una afectación, como ya lo planteaba el compañero Francisco, afecta el ecosistema, el medio ambiente, pero sobre todo la vida de un pueblo como es el pueblo vivario y la sabiduría, no solamente del pueblo vivario, sino la sabiduría de todos los humanos de este planeta, porque ahí se concentra nuestra energía, ahí está el santuario, nosotros decimos que es nuestra universidad y que todo eso, pues de alguna forma también beneficia espiritualmente a todos los humanos de este planeta. Muchas gracias.
Thank you, Santos. I'm sure that puts Anthony, Tony, a lot to take off from. And I will turn it over to Anthony, Tony Hodge, from the International Council of Women and Women.
Alice, thank you very much. There is one aspect. There's one thing that is common across all four of us that are speaking to you, and that is the recognition that things cannot go on the way they are, that there is a need for change in the way people relate to each other, in the way that people understand each other, in the way that alternative values are given the opportunity to interact and find common ground. From a company perspective, there's a growing recognition that they cannot proceed effectively without the support of local communities. From a company perspective, there's a growing understanding that the values of the Huicho people, for example, have to play a key role in decision-making. I'm the president of an organization that brings together 21 companies of the largest companies in the world. It's a young organization. It's been in place for only 10 years. And it is there because in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, in response to the explosion of the contemporary environmental community, contemporary environmental movement, the mining industry had to come to terms with the fact that the values that were being expressed inside the mining industry had diverged utterly from the values being expressed outside the mining industry. It was so bad in the 1990s that their very ability to finance the project was being questioned. At the time, a group of companies came together and said, can't carry on. So at this stage in my life, I'm working inside the industry to bring change, while the others on this panel are working outside the industry to bring change also. And that's the thread that unites every one of us here. Let me give you a sense of mining dilemmas that we face as an organization is it's all very well for companies to espouse to try to implement good practices that are respectful. In a small group, the way our companies are, how do you get to the rest of the industry? How do you affect change across an entire industry? And I tell you, there's no good answer to that. It's a dilemma for us. Because on the one hand, our companies, which wish to build better practices, wish to work with the communities that are their homes. And quite frankly, I'm a geological engineer by training, let me tell you something personal. If I go, there are university people here, if you go to the university and talk to the geological engineers and geologists, would they be the people that you go to seek advice on human relationships? Generally, they're there because the number of crunchers, because they love rocks, because they love technology, because they love chemistry, etc. And the issues that we're talking about here are all issues about how to build more effective relationships with people so that there can be common ground found, so that there is no longer an imposition of a kind of cultural genocide. In the 500 years that you mentioned, it's very real. If you go back to what was going on with the Spanish invasion of the Americas 500 years ago and much more recently, there are real issues. There is no question of that. But at this stage in the evolution of what we're doing as the modern contemporary world, do we simply stop everything? Or do we seek a solution? Do we seek a way forward that can be consistent with your values, that can offer a way forward that brings people together? Or do we just retreat to the courts, which is what has happened in this half the case that was talking to you? So I leave those ideas with you, and I'm sure we'll have some good conversation.
Thank you, Tony. And thank you all, the panelists. These people came from London, from Mexico, from El Salvador, and Washington to be with us today at Great Express to themselves. And SEJ put a lot of investment into this too. We have help from our panelists. We're getting the simultaneous translation, and this is really a high-level combination of the people who can address this burning issue. So I want to really thank you for the sacrifice that you've made, especially given the fact that we only have 5 minutes apiece. It's absurd, as has been pointed out. That's why I hope this goes on afterwards as much as possible to make this context here. And we all use metals, so it's not like we are going to stop using metals. We have to figure out some of them. I would like to get a little bit more into how prepared are communities in Latin America for this new mining boom, how prepared are investors for the fact that communities in Latin America are ever more active in terms of their knowledge about their rights. And so there's a lot that journalists need to communicate to the decision makers in public and relate it to their hometown and relate it to what make the international and local connection. So what I'm thinking of doing here now is asking each one of you, and these are the questions I'm going to put out to begin with, all four of them out. First, I would like Tony to explain to journalists some of the standards that his industry, his chamber, has actually agreed upon that they should meet. Because as a journalist myself, I didn't know that some of the things that they're trying to bring about. And if you could do that, then I would like to go back to Santos and ask what his strategy is in the face of this threat. And I need to have a few more details from Francisco about how he got involved and what what has become a legal situation in El Salvador regarding mining as a result of the Pacific Rim mine that's in his community. And that, you know, how that ends up with the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or the Free Trade Agreement situation in that moratorium on mining in El Salvador right now. Then I would like Keith to finally go over what you think are some of the ways that we can do a better job and give the journalists some ideas of what they can do and to present alternatives when they write. That's always, as a journalist, what I like to see in a story is, okay, set up the problem, but let's also talk a little bit about what the, not necessarily solutions, but how to address the problem. And then I'll be opening it up to our special guest and questions on the board. So let's go that way.
Thank you very much, Alice. The ICMM, the International Council of Mining and Metals, is not a chamber. It's not a typical association. We were created really to work with our members and with others to serve as a change agent. So it's quite different. That's a different source of conversation. 2 weeks ago when our council met, that in fact, when a company seeks membership in ICMM and when it continues membership, it commits to a set of 10 principles. These are modified from time to time by more detailed position statements. For example, recently there's been a new climate change piece of work published, which is interesting. You can see the summary of those principles is in this annual report here. Our companies are then required, and incidentally, the principles, there are 10 of them, they deal with issues like ethical operation, they deal with environmental responsibility, they deal with health and safety, they deal with learning over time, they deal with understanding products that are produced in the full life cycle of that product, and so forth. And you can have a look at them in detail there. And then our companies are required to report out annually in a third party, independently assured report that in fact they're living up to those principles. Now, are they perfect? The answer is no. My guess is that every mining company in the world, my guess is that every company in the world, my guess is that every government in the world, every community in the world has skeletons in closets. There's no exception to the mining company. But are they trying to make a difference? Yes, they very much are. They very, very much are. So there are a set of principles that are committed to. You can see the summary in here. This is a piece of work on mining and biodiversity that's outlined in the best good practice guidance. We try to work with our members to build what is good practice. This is a very recent piece of work in terms of building more effective relationships with indigenous people. This was done very much with the input of indigenous people from around the world. So our members try to establish what is good practice. They try to commit to that. They report out on it on an annual basis and put it out there for the whole world to see and make their own judgment. So tell us.
Thank you very much. We'll go to Santos.
Sí, gracias. Bien, mira, nosotros como pueblo de Raita, la estrategia que estamos haciendo para impedir de alguna forma que las empresas en nuestro sitio sagrado operen. Primeramente, estamos construyendo alianzas, articulando fuerzas entre los pueblos indígenas, no solamente en México, sino también en los países de Sudamérica, pero también de Norteamérica. Entonces, necesitamos hacer fuerza, porque hablar de dificultad es algo intocable, pues, para nosotros ahí están nuestra vida, ¿no? Y entonces es por ello que nosotros sí estamos inquietos de lo que está pasando. Es como si en la vía de la Ciudad de México se estuviera construyendo una gasolinera, ¿no? Yo creo
construyendo algún establecimiento, no creo que estarían de acuerdo los que van a ese santuario. Es de ese tamaño nuestro problema en Wirikuta, que es algo intocable, porque es sagrado. Y entonces, por ello, nosotros necesitamos hacer fuerza, pero también necesitamos exigir por la vía de recursos jurídicos, porque sabemos que el Estado mexicano no consultó a los pueblos indígenas en este caso, no consultó a los propietarios del Real 14, pero también las empresas no cumplen los requisitos ambientales. En el caso de la manifestación de impacto ambiental, estudio de suelo, entonces todo eso es una violación gravísima, pero atenta más que por encima de todos los pueblos indígenas se esté haciendo esto por intereses económicos. Entonces, no solamente afecta al pueblo Yucatán, sino que a todos los humanos de este planeta, y por ello necesitamos sumarnos, solidarizarnos, porque creo que vale más una vida que un centavo. Es por ello que nosotros como pueblo estamos apostando a la vida, no a la destrucción de nuestra vida o del medio ambiente. Invitarlos también que nosotros tenemos página en donde pueden consultar de todo el trabajo que estamos haciendo. La página es Frente en Defensa de Wirikuta.org. Y también salvemos Wirikuta.blogspot.com.
Gracias. Thank you, Santos. Gracias. Francisco, can you tell us a little bit more, please?
Bueno, el Tratado de Libre Comercio en nuestro país, en el caso de nosotros, pues nunca estuvimos de acuerdo con ese tratado de libre comercio. Fue impuesto a través de los diputados que incluso ni lo leyeron quizás. Nosotros nunca estuvimos de acuerdo porque veíamos venir ya el aprovechamiento de las empresas de hacer la sobreexplotación de los pocos recursos que tenemos. Uno de los resultados que ya tenemos es la demanda que tiene Pacific Rim contra el Estado con 100 millones de dólares. Simplemente porque el gobierno no le da permiso de extraer el oro y la plata de ellos. 100 millones de dólares para nuestro país, estamos hablando más de un presupuesto para el Ministerio de Educación y el Ministerio de Salud. Podemos ver la magnitud del problema que tiene nuestro Estado al ser demandado. Libre de ahora la empresa Pacific Rim, hay otras empresas en la misma disposición de querer seguir demandando al Estado. Eso quiere decir que ¿qué tanto va a soportar el Estado esa presión de las demandas? No creemos, es cierto, hay un espacio en el CIADI, en el Banco Mundial, pero no creemos en la transparencia que nos dicen que puede tener. ¿Cómo yo me meto a esto? Bueno, es de mi papá, mi mamá nos enseñó a cuidar la tierra, que es nuestra nana, porque ahí comemos, bebemos. Y es lo más importante. Para nosotros, el agua es fundamental. Y creo que podemos vivir sin oro, pero sin agua, yo no sé quién de nosotros podemos vivir. En nuestra comunidad se nos secó el río, el único que está, allá en el 2004. Y de esa manera fuimos a revisar por qué se había secado ese nacimiento de agua. Y era porque las bombas de la empresa Pacific Rim estaba extrayendo el agua para la lubricación de la maquinaria para la exploración. Entonces, por eso fue que empezamos a movilizarnos y nos preocupamos. Fuimos a las autoridades, pero lastimosamente las autoridades, así como muchas partes del mundo, por el visto, como dicen en El Salvador, baila el mono. Lastimosamente, llegamos del alcalde y el alcalde dice, no, yo no me puedo meter en eso. A pesar de que como autoridad es una obligación de velar y de proteger los recursos y defender nuestros derechos como ciudadanos y como humanos que somos. Pero no se preocupó. Debido a eso es que decidimos organizarnos y empezar a hacer resistencia a nivel de comunidades, luego a nivel de país y luego a nivel centroamericano y que también estamos a nivel latinoamericano. Eso nos ha ayudado porque hemos ido conociendo las diferentes experiencias que tienen los países donde ya hay explotación minera metálica. Y no queremos como salvadoreños llegar a tener esa situación que ya viven amigos centroamericanos y latinoamericanos por la explotación minera. En nuestro país hay una crisis de agua muy grande y ahora está considerado dentro de los países de mayor riesgo. Incluso ahorita acabamos de pasar un problema por las tormentas, inundaciones. Lastimosamente nuestro país es una condición muy diferente a otros países. Densidad poblacional. Tenemos de 300 a 350 habitantes por kilómetro cuadrado. No así Canadá. Estamos hablando de 3 habitantes por kilómetro. O sea, los problemas son diferentes. Estamos hablando de una de un río nada más que le da fuente a más del 50% de nuestro país, que es el río Lempa. Y todas las empresas mineras están ubicadas sus concesiones en la zona de recarga del río Lempa. ¿Qué quiere decir? Que si hay permiso de explotación minera en nuestro país, el río se termina por completo. Y eso quiere decir que se termina la vida también para nuestro país. Debido a eso, es que el problema minero en nuestro país es de vida o muerte.
I'll add a few additional comments to what's been said. I want to pick up on one thing that Tony said, which was how can an institution like ICMM influence the broader mining industry, which goes much farther than just the member companies that are represented there. That's a critical question. There is quite a wide variation in terms of social and environmental performance within the mining industry. Larger companies, not all of them, but many of them tend to be more responsible because they simply have more capacity and greater reputational risk they don't act responsibly. Again, that's not in all cases, but in many cases that is the case. There are some examples in which mining companies have done positive things, like disclosing payments that they're making to governments and also engaging effectively in community development dialogue. But unfortunately, in our opinion, that's to go broadly enough across the industry. In particular, the smaller companies, which, with no disrespect to our representatives from the Canadian Council, tend to have native, if they're raising capital at Toronto Stock Exchange. So, if they're in America, we see the smaller Canadian junior companies often are the ones that have the most problems in terms of social or environmental issues. And I think they create problems for the rest of the industry. So some sort of industry peer pressure on the smaller companies in particular to get them to start acting more responsibly, addressing these issues, engaging with communities in a more serious way. That's simply to go in, make a quick pilot, and try to turn around and sell the project to larger companies. So that's a particular concern and issue that we need to address. There are some specific issues in terms of the procedures and processes by which mining projects are approved that need urgent attention. One is the independence of the assessment, the environmental impact assessments that are done for mining projects. In many situations, those assessments are produced by the companies themselves. They're not subject to any sort of independent external review. And because of that, they don't enjoy the confidence of the communities. They simply don't believe the information that they're receiving from the companies. That situation needs to change. There needs to be more independent information. Communities need to have access to independent experts who can advise them in the process and have dialogue and negotiation with companies about what the actual impacts are. Environmental, social, and others are likely to be of mining. That's an important step that we think needs to be taken. Strengthening the governance of the mining industry across the region is also a critical issue. And so I think it would be an interesting investigative journalism piece to actually look at what is the capacity within the governance to effectively manage mining. Even in a country like Peru, which has had mining for centuries, is one of the largest mining countries in the world. The capacity of the government, the environmental ministry in Peru, to manage all of that mining, ensure that it's respecting the environment and protecting communities, is limited, as assessments by the World Bank have demonstrated. So, strengthening that capacity, providing the appropriate staff, the appropriate resources, the appropriate information, so that the government can ensure that mining companies are protecting the environment and doing what they should be doing is critically important. And also establishing, strengthening the independence of the oversight bodies within government that have responsibility for monitoring and enforcing regulations on mining. In the case of Peru, again, the ultimate responsibility for improving environmental impact assessments for mining projects lies with the Ministry of Energy and Mines, not the Ministry of Environment, so the state of conservation there. And that is something that feeds into the concerns and anxieties and protests that the communities engage in, because they just don't believe that the government is taking care of their best interests. So that's a situation that can be addressed. And then finally, two other things that I would mention. I think it's important for mining companies to start taking up on the idea of not mining in particular areas, either for social or environmental reasons. And ICMM has endorsed a series of no-go areas where they won't mine. I think that kind of practice needs to be broadened to include environmentally sensitive areas, socially sensitive areas. The Amazon region right now is a place where there's mining exploration going on. As of right now, there's not a significant amount of large-scale mining, it's like small-scale mining, which has significant impacts, as people know. But there is a significant amount of large-scale mining. If that were to start happening, the impacts could be pretty severe, so we would submit that would be an area where companies can consider simply saying they won't go. And then finally, this question that, again, Tony referenced, which is the acceptance of communities. This is for us absolutely critical that companies have to obtain the consent of communities before they start operating. If they don't have that, ultimately the project is not going to be sustainable. We're going to face protests, we're going to face cost overruns. Again, the second example of Peru, just last week there were major protests at the Yanacocha mine, which is the largest coal mine in Latin America. The company suspended operations for a time because communities were blockading the highway because they were concerned about the impacts of the mine on water that they use for agricultural purposes. So avoiding situations like that, making sure that companies have the approval and consent of communities from their community is critical and an important step towards trying to reduce the level of conflict and problems we see around the sector.
Okay, thank you very much for the informative second round. And don't worry, people, we were asked to start this session late, so everybody will have a chance for their questions. And first of all, I would like to invite Luis Leje to come up here and take my seat for 2 minutes. She is a Canadian Consul General here in Miami, a career Foreign Service officer. She has served as Canada's ambassador to Panama and Costa Rica, with concurrent accreditation to Nicaragua and Honduras. So she has seen firsthand as these countries try to develop their natural resources. As well, while on assignment in Ottawa, she led the team that developed Canada's corporate social responsibility strategy. And that is better known as Building the Canadian Advantage, a corporate social responsibility for the Canadian extractive sector. Luis.
Thank you very much, Kathleen, and thank all of you for having me here this morning, and to the panelists for having given us a really frank, I think, assessment of the way they are seeing things in my today. As was indicated, I served in several Latin American countries. My first one actually was Colombia. So I think that I've seen firsthand the opportunities and the challenges that these countries face. Let me just say that most of you that are not from Canada or the U.S. are probably from Latin America. Canada has quite an extensive strategy for the Americas. It's been ongoing since 2007. And there are three main pillars, two of which I think are quite relevant to the discussion that we've had so far and that we will be having. One is prosperity, how to bring prosperity to the Americas and governance. So important for those countries. And most of you know that we have a corporate social responsibility as governments. Since 2009, it's got four main pillars, which we're going to go into later. I have 2 minutes now, so I'm not going to go into it. It was a long struggle to get to it, but I think it's a very comprehensive strategy and one that is being applied and one that really touches on a lot of what's been talked about today in terms of how we do things better, governance being the very first one. I just want to read you one sentence that you will see in just about every bit of literature that's been put together by the Government of Canada on this topic, and that is, the Government of Canada encourages and expects all Canadian companies working international to respect all applicable laws and international standards, to operate transparently and in consultations with the host government and local communities, and to conduct their activities in a socially and environmentally responsible manner. You will see that everywhere, and my team that now I've left, I'm in Miami, and the team that continues to work on corporate social responsibility, this is what they are saying day in and day out to our country. Domestically, we have lots of rules, regulations. Those of you that are following the news and you're journalists, of course, you are. Canada is quickly becoming an energy superpower. We have a lot of energy. We have hydro, we have oil, we have gas, we have nuclear, and we have oil sands. And in oil sands, which is the topic of our Keystone, you hear oil sands all the time now. There's massive demonstrations here in the U.S. What you have to know is the federal government with the provincial governments working hand in hand to develop rules and regulations to ensure that we do at home as well as we're reaching companies to do abroad. It's more than just words on paper. I mean, if you look at all the websites, if you see everything that's being done, not only domestically but internationally, the government, and after all, governments don't do corporate social responsibility, as companies do social responsibility. We are there to encourage, to expect, to train, and to guide.
Thank you very much, Luis. I would like to encourage you, when you ask your questions, to also feel free to direct them to the Consul General. And I would like to invite Orlando Cabrera to come up and take my place. Orlando is actually a program manager in Montreal for the North American Commission on Environmental Cooperation. And he knows quite a bit about the measures that should be in place for mining to take place in a responsible mandatory measures.
Thank you. Central America, where they are considering establishing a regional community and factor base for Central America in San Diego. And that project has been approved and is moving forward. So they were interested in knowing about the benefits of doing a regional community basis and project registry to deal with regional environmental issues. And we're very happy that our project is taken as a model. So I just trying to build here the connection between all these activities that are happening. Of course, they are not solving any of the problems right now, however, at least that is happening.
Yeah, that's that. Thank you very much, Orlando. It's a groundwork which should be laid for this finding. Now, I will ask the people who are in SCJ as working journalists to be at the first with their questions and come to the microphone that I'm going to put. Because translators have to have your voice come to the microphone. You can come up here. Who would like to speak? Would you come up here, please? And you can come up and get in line with your questions. And I would encourage the panelists to ask questions too. I'm not sure.
I'm Carrie Weatherson. I'm a journalist, and I've covered the Pacific Rim case and some other mining issues. And I guess for Tony or Louise, that in terms of Pacific Rim, I know that, or maybe to start with for Louise, in terms of the idea that Canadian companies should respect local laws, and in a case where they're going under CAFTA, which may give the company the rights to recover funds, but you know, is very, in this case, I think pretty obvious that the at the community and the national level, you know, they don't want, they have said no to this project and to mining in general for the time being. So is that the kind of thing where the national government would, you know, put any pressure or has any actual authority over Pacific Rim's actions? And then I don't know if Pacific Rim is one of your members, but no. Yeah, because they are in one of the, I'm not sure if you're one of your members, but the idea that, you know, building relationships is one thing, but is there a point where your members recognize, even if you disagree, if you think the mine in a certain place is a good idea, you know, is there a point where you just recognize the community or national governments saying no and kind of leave it at that?
Thank you very much. I think it was Tony who touched upon it. Both government capacity is crucial here. And in fact, one of the pillars of our strategy is just that. How do we work with local governments, host governments, so that they understand that giving a concession is the easy part? And where you give the concession is now going to become a real crucial element. But afterwards, companies would come to me, especially when I was in Panama and again in Costa Rica because I had Honduras, and they'll say, we're quite happy to follow the rules, but what happens when there are no rules? And what happens when there's no mining code? Then it doesn't matter what we do, if we get accused of something, good or bad, and I'm not passing judgment here, what are we going to be held accountable to and against what? And that's why the second pillar of our strategy is the promotion of various international codes. Tony made allusions to 10 different things. We have, and these are internationally recognized codes that we ask companies to follow. And the first one being the OECD Code on Work for Multinationals, then there's the World Bank International Performance Standards, Performance Indicators. We've got the Voluntary Principles for Security and Human Rights. All these things to give companies at least an equal footing. They should all know what's expected of them, okay, expected, and we encourage them to follow these things so that they, when things start going not exactly the way they expected, they at least can say, well, this is what I've been following because there's really no rule in this particular country. I'm not familiar totally with the case of Pacific Rim in El Salvador to see what's happened there. I must say, when I heard that they were suing the government using Kafka, I'm not sure I get the angle there either, but then I'm not a lawyer. But those are the kinds of things in the strategy that we're saying, okay, so we're going to help you and we're paying. We've got big projects in the Andean countries, for example, Peru, Colombia, Bolivia. We've just announced more in Africa to help countries help themselves develop, as you were suggesting, Tony, independent analysis. Anybody will see that if you're the company that develops the impact, the environmental impact study, and then you're the one that's going to grade your own impact study, I mean, who's going to take you seriously? There's got to be a mechanism there that countries can help themselves to the benefit of their own people by doing independent analysis, independent inspections, all of these things. But countries have a role to play as well. I mean, you know, how important it is to deal with communities. Well, I remember dealing, now we're talking 15 years ago, in Panama, dealing with mining companies who thought, and these were juniors, didn't have much international experience, and they say, well, I got a concession from the government. Why should I have to deal with the communities? That's not my problem. I'm here to see if there's anything under the ground. Well, and you go to the government and you say, well, maybe we should consult with the community before you granted the concession. Well, no. The company can do that and say, well, we've got a problem here. And now I think we're together trying to develop the mechanisms to make sure that these communications actually happen.
Implementada este año y rebarantada, y las empresas
such that something has to change. But the demand that the government of Canada should take on that solution, I don't think in the end is helpful. And that's what was really happening behind C-3, which is a toughie. You look to the government of Canada's good guy right now, but it's a double-edged sword. Are they going to become the international policeman? That's what they're being asked to do, the government of Canada. I don't care what politics you are, they're going to say no to that, because that has never been the Canadian government. I'm sorry, to respond to that, please, yeah, it's not anything. I wanted to, what was the other question? This issue, Keith made a point about government peer pressure to some extent. Now, let me give you a bit more context. So we are 21 companies out of 6,000. Let me be fair. The 21 companies that represent employ about 1 million people out of about 2.5 million in the whole mining industry worldwide. So it's a very significant portion of the industry. From the point of view of the production of commodities, 30 to 40% of most major commodities are produced through the companies that we represent. So it's a very, very significant corner of the mining industry. However, I think there's something, and the peer pressure issue is a real thing, and I can tell you one of the issues I have to deal with is the fight inside the mining industry between small and large companies. The small companies sometimes feel that the large companies are just wanting to put them all out of business. It's vicious. That's an aspect of the change that the outside world doesn't see so much, and that I'm in a position of having to walk that fine line of trying to cause that change. But there's one other factor that hasn't been mentioned. I have noticed in the last 18 months a huge change, and that is that it is unbelievable to us how many phone calls we're now getting from the financial services industry asking what the standards are that our companies have to live up to. And we have learned that the Equator Banks, of which there are about 72 of the major lending institutions in the world, certainly some of them, and I don't know how many yet, are actually using membership in our organization as a tick-off box where they do due diligence on whether or not they're going to finance something. That's beginning to filter down into the juniors. And our major companies are beginning to demand of juniors that they adhere to these standards. And the reality of how the mining industry works is that the exploration companies and the juniors end up being the feeders for the larger companies. It's an aspect of how the system operates that many people on the outside don't understand. And the majors more and more recognizing that if the juniors screw up, they end up having to pay the price. So they're no longer willing to buy or move on projects if they've been royally mucked up by the juniors. So there is change on that score, but is it fast enough? I'm not sure.
Okay, I think that was a really good question and answer. Okay, we have a few minutes before we go to lunch, and the order is Andrea, Enrique, Sofia, and Alexander.
Bueno, yo también voy a hablar en español. Hola, yo soy Andrea, soy de Chile. Y Chile es un país minero, es una de sus principales exportaciones en la minería. Y respecto a eso, yo quiero contar que, bueno, como en todos los países se hacen estudios de evaluación de impacto ambiental de muchos proyectos mineros, los cuales, a pesar de que tienen muchas observaciones por parte de distintos organismos y también de la ciudadanía, igualmente se aprueban. Entonces yo también quiero preguntarle, a lo mejor a Tony o a Keith, ¿cómo se puede llegar a un equilibrio entre el desarrollo económico que le entrega un país la minería, pero también la sustentabilidad y también la reducción del impacto medioambiental que la minería puede conllevar?
Thank you.
can be argued is related to the structure of economy, which is in the soil and concentrated with that concentrated wealth, and sort of economic analysis of mining, sort of the impacts it has on communities that it is considered. But I think that sort of assessing the cost and benefits over the long term is a critical part of answering that question. Yes, mining will generate revenue, especially with minerals and gold prices where they are now. That is a source of revenue for governments that they definitely need. But what ultimately is the cost of that, especially over the long term, in terms of things like the environmental cleanup costs that will have to be made by somebody, most likely the governments. Some of the other kinds of economic impacts that
is not accepted. That sort of crap that's gone on over the centuries. And it still is happening, and I don't know when that was taken. Maybe within the last year. That way of doing business has to stop. And the progressive companies are a way of interacting with the community where you impose your will on local people. In a way that some of those other things were reflecting on there in terms of the burning of local houses and in terms of the oppression of local people. You can't go on that. It's not acceptable to do that. And progressive companies are recognizing that. Now, 21 out of 6,000, as Keith said earlier, this is a problem with mining.
Can you give an example? What he wants an example.
Yeah, I mean, I flipped through a report that I did 10 years ago, actually, before coming over here. And there's some wonderful examples. I'm from British Columbia, Canada, originally. And annually, the Mining Association of BC gives an award for companies that have demonstrated effective relationships and effective projects within the context of sustainability. And I'm going to tell you that there's some wonderful examples. There's a project on the west coast of Vancouver that happens to be industrial minerals, sand and gravel. It was done prior to them even considering it. They interacted with the elders and the indigenous people of that area. They built the project collaboratively with that people. There is a sharing of ownership. There is a sharing of benefits. It was all worked out with the local community. That project started out 2 or 3 years ago. It's going. The community is delighted with it. The company is winning awards. So there are beginning to be examples. Do they represent the norm? Not yet.
Okay, thank you. Now, there's more details in the literature, right? About the good examples. Sophia and Alejandra, and I'm not sure if we might have to go to lunch after that. We have, besides Sophia and Alejandra, back here, one more. and also Armando. But, so let's make the questions and the answers real quick. Otherwise, our translators are going to be bad, and we're not going to get to lunch on time. But we can keep talking afterwards.
Hi, I'm Sofia Galimantes. I am from PAMA. I'm the science editor of PAMA of the Americas magazine. So I have two very specific questions. The first one is for you. What kind of criteria does the Canadian government use or have to go into, or its companies, to go into countries that have no mining regulation codes? In other words, does it assume the same criteria that it would use to go to mining in Canada and different communities, whether they're indigenous or non-indigenous? So that's what we. And for Tony, sorry, I started to lose. My question is, I think what I'd like to know specifically in terms of why the mining industry seems to be pumping the mines of Latin America or the land in Latin America, why now? Why are we seeing this movement from Canada? You mentioned earlier that Canada's being looked at as an energy superpower. But Canada is also a country that sort of developed the idea of environmental sustainability. So to me, it's a bit of a contradiction in terms. So I'd like to know why the demand today for minerals for mines from Latin America. Don't know if I made my question clear.
Very quickly, the Canadian government, we don't have the criteria. I mean, the companies are asked to follow all applicable laws. So if they're wanting to do mining in Panama, they start with Panamanian laws. In the absence of those, and I'm sure the
The results of the consultation are fine. That's certainly a fair question. One that's come up repeatedly around mining projects in which companies or governments will engage in essentially pro forma consultation processes that don't really mean anything, don't make any actual difference in terms of the decision that's only being made about whether and under what conditions the project will move forward. As I said, that's an important question. I think that there are two things that need to be addressed here. One is to actually strengthen the legal framework around consultation processes in these countries. And so, the case of Peru, which I mentioned earlier, there is now a new law on this that requires the consent of indigenous peoples to obtain core products. Well, it says that explicitly in the new consultation law. Okay, so that's about as strong piece of legislation in the region I've ever seen. That creates a whole new paradigm that mining companies are sort of right now scrambling to figure out what this is actually in practice. There's discussion about how this will actually be implemented and regulated, but establishing that legal framework in Peru is an important step forward. I think an important step forward is actually making these consultation processes more meaningful and actually providing a real opportunity for companies to implement the decision that is actually ultimately made. The other aspect of that is that I think that whether or not consultation processes are legally binding, they are things that companies should respect. Companies, whether or not they're legally obligated to do so, should listen to the results of the consultation processes. And if the community says no, then that needs to be respected, or if it says yes, but under certain conditions, that also needs to be respected. So I think there's a lot of money on the part of companies in terms of actually listening to the results of the consultation processes and making sure that they are taken into
account. In terms of Ecuador, I am surprised that there are laws that prohibit the direct interaction between companies here, work companies and indigenous people. I was not aware of that, and I think that is tremendous difficulty, but I'm not aware of the legal issues.
Oh, well, that makes that shorter. We are going to take only 5 more minutes because otherwise we won't get to lunch in time. So could you ask your question real quickly? The answer there, and you, Armand.
Buenas tardes para todos. Soy Elisa del Caño, soy periodista de Colombia. En nuestro país, a partir del próximo 1 de enero, se va a regular la ley de regalías. Esto significa que los recursos de las empresas mineras se van a destinar especialmente para el momento de la investigación. En un país donde en Colombia no hay ni siquiera llegamos al 0.5% de investigación y destinos de recursos del PIB. Ahora, quisiera saber, ¿hay algún mecanismo? Porque hay una preocupación muy cierta de las universidades a las cuales tienen los destinos o los recursos de las regalías por explotación minera en Colombia para regular desde la ética que efectivamente la corrupción que impera tristemente en mi país, pues esos recursos se ajusten. Si hay algún precedente para ello, alguna normativa ética desde las organizaciones y si hay algún precedente similar en el resto de Latinoamérica y el resto del mundo donde los recursos mineros van a tener una destinación específica, no sé lo que es, en un, que se estima puede ser por lo menos 1 billón de pesos al año. Gracias.
used for. And from a mining company perspective, the more openness about what that money is used for, it's advantageous for the mining companies. They want the world to know if resources are going into a central government and not getting out to the communities, because the communities are the ones that are going to either benefit or carry the costs. And if the resources are all going into central government and they're disappearing because of corruption, or they're disappearing into some paper project in another corner of the country, and the community that is hosting the mines getting nothing, that's a tremendous concern. These companies are the ones who get blamed for that quite unjustifiably. So there's a movement internationally to be more open about how the resources that are generated from the mining activity that affect communities are distributed across the government, a country. It's very delicate, though, because the national government or the regional government wants to maintain control of what it does with its resources. So once again, you're actually a tension issue. In the case of Peru, people might know more about this than I do. In the case of Peru, there has been a law passed that requires a certain amount of resources from extractive industries to go to local communities. At the moment, local communities don't have the capacity to effectively spend that money. So it's just sitting there. So there are other issues here that are really critical.
Sure, I'll just make one thing. This is another really difficult problem in terms of the management of the revenues that come from mining. Because frequently they're not managed transparently, they're not distributed directly back to the communities that are most affected. And as Tony said, there is often not the capacity at the local level to spend the money appropriately when it is distributed. I can't cite a specific example that I would point to right now as a positive example of a country that's really worked out in a developing country, at least, but has really worked this out in terms of how you actually use the mining revenue in a constructive way that contributes to sustainable development in the long term that avoids problems of corruption and other things that were mentioned. One thing I would say is that it is now the law of the United States that mining companies that sell their stock, your stock, which I think is almost all the ICE companies, many other companies around the world, are now required to disclose the payments on a project-by-project basis to governments in which other countries in which are on. So we think that this is an important step forward on the EITF, to actually opening this process up, allowing more information to come in, and allowing more opportunity for citizens and society to have a voice in actually deciding how these revenues are used and where they should be invested.
Okay, thank you very much. We have 2 minutes left, so each question gets to wait a second.
Can I ask how this bill is done just to react to what they've heard from a human rights standpoint? Because I think we really need to hear more from them, if you don't mind my saying so.
Thank you. Translators are not supposed to stay here any longer. So I think it depends
for
on...
For human rights, you can stay 5 minutes, 2 minutes.
I can translate.
Okay, cool. Okay, do translators want to be free? No, they don't want to be free. They're going to volunteer their time. Okay, so the only thing is we do have to leave in a few minutes to get that lunch. Oh, we'll get lunch.
Hacer un comentario al respecto de las regalías. En realidad, un ejemplo en El Salvador. Según la ley, dice que el 2% es el pago de impuestos de la empresa, de las ganancias. Y a la empresa le quedaría el 98%. Pueden imaginarse qué podemos hacer con el 2%. La otra situación es de que muchas empresas, la parte de la regalía, lo utiliza para crear problemas sociales en nuestras comunidades. Ejemplo, yo estoy en contra de la minería, pero le da regalía a mi hermano para que él entre en conflictos conmigo. La otra es la parte de regalías a las autoridades locales. Le da regalía a las autoridades locales para de esa manera no haya un control. Y de esa manera los alcaldes pueden seguir comprando votos y siguen manteniendo
we are in a deep ethical crisis at a planetary level. I mean, how important is gold? How important is silver? You mentioned, Kelly, that we all need metals. We all do need mining industry. That is, we're not against the mining industry. We just, I think that as a human species, we need to really come to grasp as to what is the effect of greed on this planet. The sacred Saitavini Buddha is a metaphor of the, what is sacred to the people of Mexico, of the indigenous people. And I think that the movie Avatar, in a way, was spoken to. And so I just, I don't know how to defend Vini Buddha in the world of laws, in the world of man, in the world of business, in good practice. I do not believe there is good practice, good mining practice in the sacred site, period. I think that a line needs to be drawn somehow, somewhere, whether it be through government, whether it be through corporate ethic, and being capable of understanding where the limits are from a human perspective, not from having to go through the legal procedures and or all of the instances that make this defense of the sacred land so difficult for us. So I just wanted to put this last word in here and hoping in Tony's words on how perhaps now spiritual territory can be viewed as places where, you know, mining will not go in there. And I'm just praying. I'm just praying because we have no legal recourse. The government is really not helping us out. We come here all the way to Miami to call to the international community in a cry for help, in a cry for people to wake up to the fact that gold does not feed the people, does not cure cancer, neither does silver. It is all about corporate greed. And so I would just like to have, you know, your people and your mining consortium or group or whatever to help us. Help us. You know, not help yourselves by trying to keep a good practice, but actually helping us by influencing those mining companies that are transgressing and that are attempting against a cultural, spiritual, and ecological system that is very valuable to our people in Mexico.
Thank you, Armando. And your organization, please?
I am with the Secretary of Defense of Iguta. Yes.
So that is a great place to end in terms of going forward to lunch and that, where you can talk about that some more. Yes, thank you all very much for your patience and